Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. On behalf of our family of hosts, staff, and the millions of listeners who have tuned in since 2009, we want to wish you happy holidays and ask for your support as we launch our daily in-house news coverage. Please consider making us a part of your end-of-year giving in 2013. Your membership donation is tax-deductible and the best way to show you believe in our work and the importance of a free, food-focused media resource. Consider donating today at heritageradionetwork.org by clicking the Donate button. Thanks for your support and enjoy the show.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. But every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, I enjoy, and I hope that you enjoy it too. I look forward to this half hour every week because I enjoy having a really intellectual, stimulating, sensorially challenging conversation about taste. And today I'm really super excited because my guest is the author of the new, I will call it a biography. I don't really know what to call it. I call it a biography of the Food Network. It's called From Scratch, Inside the Food Network. And you've heard me say this before. I receive a lot of books. We receive tons of books. Right now, the Beard Awards submission process is underway. And so there are stacks and stacks and stacks of books. But many of them find their way to my desk and they sit there for months and months and months. And I will confess, I didn't want to pick this one up. I just thought, oh, here we go. My God, you know, enough already. And in anticipation of Alan Salkin, my guest today coming on the show, I started to read it and I could not put it down. Everyone in the office would be like, would you shut up already? As I would read them passages of the book. So it's a real pleasure to have you here to talk about this great contribution, I think, to understanding the last 20 years of American food.
Thanks, Mitchell. That somebody like you loves the book means a lot to me. It really does.
Well, and I, you know, people will tell you around me, I don't mince words. The thing that was so interesting to me is it wasn't sensationalized, not nearly as much as the network itself, but it just opened a whole world of how TV is made, of how it came to be, of the process by which this idea on the cheap would turn into such an impactful and I think really important part of our food culture. And I guess I want to start just by, did you know something that led you to believe you were going to be able to write this book like this? Or,
oh my God, if I'd known what it was going to take, you know, but you know, I went down to the South Beach Food and Wine Festival, which, you know, as you know, is the Sundance Film Festival of that business, the TV food business.
With more alcohol, maybe.
More alcohol and you know, more arrests for alcohol. anyway, people, when they pay $200 for an entry to an all-you-can-drink event, they try to drink all they can drink. But I was amazed to see that those people who would pay $200 to just get within 100 feet of Rachel Ray, that these people like Rachel and Bobby and Emeril all had bodyguards and hangers-on and Italian agents. And this was the year that Emeril had sold his business for $50 million to Martha Stewart, 5-0. And I just, you know, I said, what the hell is going on here? Which I'm sure you've thought in your years of how it went from nothing to something, you know, that these chefs were now stars like this. And I think I just, you know, I felt like because at that time I was in New York, I'd been at the New York Times, mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I've got enough sort of reputation probably associated with being part of that institution of the Times that I could pull this off and tell the story of how I'm a guy who doesn't like writing about the Kennedys, World War II,
right,
mafia. I like new territory.
Right.
And I thought, you know, The United States of Arugula was a great book. Mm-hmm. Loved it.
Another one I didn't want to pick up and then couldn't put down.
Wonderful book. But I thought this angle, the TV part and the entertainment was fresh, and I was the man for the job.
Well, you certainly were. And And I'll say again, it isn't a story about food. No one who loves food or loves to cook or whatever should jump into this just because of that. This is the story of a business enterprise, of a cultural phenomenon, of a moment in time that has really had a tremendous impact on food.
That's right. And, you know, it's funny from a marketing perspective as the author. I mean, I love just talking about what's in the book and but it's been hard because some people want nothing but, you know, backstage, you know, emerald, you know, banging chicks or something, which there is a little of that in there because it's candy and I want to keep people moving through it. But it is, as you're saying, and I'm just really glad that you saw that it really is a biography of this network, which has played a central role in so many of our lives and which created the food revolution for a lot of people. It discovered this small thing that was out there and helped popularize it and then changed it and then tried to adapt with it and mm-hmm. sometimes lost control of it, of course.
Let's go right there. It developed it. It did not begin with people who were interested in food. It began with people who knew something about community television and did some research and thought maybe here's an idea, which I think is great.
Yeah, it was a money play.
Right.
You know, we were in the early 90s. There was 35 cable channels. It's hard to remember. There was almost no internet. You know, there was AOL.
And, probably more to watch, but that's another story.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's easier to make decisions, right. That's for sure. And, and there was this ghetto of food TV on PBS on the weekend mornings. I don't know if you know Jeffrey Drummond, but he produced a lot of that programming for Julia and others, the Frugal Gourmet. And these guys in Providence, Rhode Island, realized there was the coming 500-channel universe. And it was just a play. They just wanted to see. You know, they tried a pet channel. They thought that was an idea, but it turns out that dogs do not
watch TV.
They do watch TV, but they don't make purchasing decisions about which car they want or which cruise vacation to go on. Therefore, they're not good consumers.
The next generation, maybe.
Maybe. Hopefully, you know, the smart dogs.
Right.
Anyway, and so then, you know, this was just a play. And the guy that whose first idea was, his only interest was pizza.
Right.
At least he had a food interest. And Reese Schoenfeld, the first president, had his kitchen removed like a great New Yorker.
One of the most famous stories that's still told, yes.
Yeah. In place of the kitchen, they had nothing but a cabinet with dog food and a coffee maker.
Amazing. And so the beauty also is that you are writing now about people we feel like we know. I mean, we have watched all the time. And the characters... To me, the development, both how they come from deers in headlights who are thrown in front of TV, most of them horrible from the start, but perhaps some people see something, someone champions them, they turn them into something else. But to me, the piece that was so interesting was they all get a taste and want more. They sort of, they no one knows what this is going to become, but suddenly, wait, they're watching, I'm in front of a camera, and that kind of propels the whole thing in some ways.
It is interesting, isn't it? Very few people ever, turn their back on it.
Right. Amazing.
Once they get a taste, like Tyler Florence, there's that story in there where he just gets called in to do a quick demo and he just realizes how much he loves it, you know, immediately the lights on him. And of course, you know, yes, it's good to be famous. I tell that to people.
Right.
Like you see this, it's fun and people throw themselves at you and offer you beautiful things.
Right. And it's addictive, it seems, in the story. You need more. And
they
when it goes away...
Oh, they don't like it. They really... I mean, Sarah Moulton is still bitching about, you know, what happened to her and how unfair it was. And it goes
so
on and on.
We'll get into that, because I find that the sort of trajectory and the abrupt stops in some of the trajectories really fascinating. But another topic, did you know anything about TV when you started? Did you have to do any TV research, or wasn't that the point, really?
I knew a little, you know, I'd written a little about TV here and there, but as far as this history of cable TV, and you know, the situation we're in now where cable is so expensive really starts back in this era in 93 when the thing started. And I had to learn about the whole detail, the Cable Act of 93 and the retransmission consent, which is the problem now, that law, which is why cable's so expensive. But I tried my best to make it fun, you know, to sum it up. This is what I do as a journalist, right? I take complicated information and I make it palatable for the masses, and that's what I tried to do.
And you succeeded,
Thank you.
So another piece about let's go back to the beginning of the Food Network, and in some ways it hasn't even changed, that I loved is, and it reminds me of throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks. And I once had the fortune of sitting next to an original producer of James Beard's first TV show, which is in 1946. That's a long time ago. TV was a year old. And in fact, we learned only recently he'd been on a few times in 1945, so during the first 6 months of television. And what we could never find any remnants of it, and that just surprised us. And what the producer said to us was, first of all, it cost a fortune, whatever they did it on and stored it on, so they would only reuse the drums. But second of all, no one knew what would happen, and they'd throw anyone in front of the camera and see what would stick. And here we are in the 90s, you know, much smarter, much more media savvy. And the same thing is true. They just throw it in front of the camera and see what sticks. They'll put it up, broadcast it, and maybe someone will watch, and then they'll make another one.
Yeah, they had that show, Chef du Jour, where everyone would get a shot for 5 episodes, basically, over two days. And they would just, you know, it turned out they realized they don't like people with foreign accents.
which excludes 3/4 of the great chefs.
Yes, it's true. And it's really unfair. And I don't even think it's fair to the viewers, but nevertheless.
Didn't stop Jacques Pepin, but that's a whole other thing.
And anyone else, that's right. And it took Emeril, though, when you watch his early tapes and his early shows, the ones you can find, he was awful. He was awful. He was like hunched over.
I remember
and stiff
that. Yeah.
And, you know, his first show was How to Boil Water, which literally it was like turn on stove, make sure pilot light is lit, water in pot. You know, he moved on to such complex dishes as grilled cheese sandwiches, which are hard to make the cheese melt without burning the bread, to be fair.
Emeril, a great chef, it
he
must
is
always
a great
be said.
Chef.
One of the great chefs, yes.
Tremendous and innovative and really, you know, brought, you know, along with Paul Prudhomme maybe, brought, you know. And by the way, I don't even know that much about food. I've had to learn that. I'm not really I learned by hanging out with people do this book and...
That's why I think the book is so compelling, I have to say. That's why David Camp's book was so compelling, because you were learning about it and your perspective wasn't from the inside.
That's
I think
good. Thank
that
you.
It's just that outside thing is what made both of those stories interesting.
And I went to Berkeley, you know, in the 80s, and so that I was around what was happening in Berkeley in the 80s is almost what's happening in the rest of the world now still. But but Emeril, it took him so long, and then finally it was his third show, Emeril Live, where all of a sudden you get that fully fledged, you know, the bam and the confidence, and it takes time. And one of the points I think I make in the book is that nobody gets any time anymore, and everyone gets thrown in, you know, thrown
into
in,
a competition.
You get knocked out in the first round and you're toast.
Amazing. It's funny to be having this conversation because I think just this week, Discovery offered $3.5 billion for Scripps, which is the parent company of the Food Network.
I'm hopeful. I don't know if there was a number. It's interesting. They're certainly talking in the billions, that I know. And, you know, there's been talk for years about Disney making an offer. Mm-hmm. And I do think, and I've been sort of thinking about an article about this and tweeting about it, that, you know, Scripps, the Food Network seems to be at a little bit of a creative standstill or a lot of a creative standstill. They don't really know what the Food Network star is anymore. Mm. When you watch Next Food Network Star, it's like they're trying to find the perfect Food Network star for 2003.
Yes, I exactly, right.
And nobody, you know,
which is closer to, which is closer to Julia Child than what has been successful apparently on the network by what they show.
Although I would say, my opinion is they need more of that comfort food that was the key to their success. But they're at a standstill, and maybe a company like Discovery or somebody else can break this lock, because ultimately it's owned by Scripps, which is in Knoxville, and it's sort of a conservative Southern company, and they're just, it's very corporate, and they don't seem to be taking the chances. They all say, we're waiting for the next Duck Dynasty to walk in, but they would say no to Duck Dynasty
were presented to them. Interesting. And they said no to some important things.
They had Anthony Bourdain. He would have kept going if they just kept financing him, but they told him after his second season of A Cook's Tour, they said, the shows you did where you went to Southern barbecue joints in the U.S. got better ratings than when you went and had caipirinhas in Brazil. We don't want you to travel internationally anymore. And he had this deal lined up to film Ferran Adria at work, the first person to do it. And he said, no, if I can't do it my way, I don't want to do it. The credit to him. And that led him to Travel Channel. And then when Scripps bought Travel Channel, he ended up on CNN.
Amazing. So there is... You tell many trajectories like that, as I said before, and sometimes you start at the end, sitting in the room where a show's going to be canceled and no one can believe it because it's been successful. We are going to have to take a quick break, but I want to talk about what, I mean, it's a little bit about what we were just talking about. They're finding the past that they sort of, you exploit a success and that comes to a natural end. And what, why that process works that way and where we find new things, we'll be right back. I'm talking to Alan Salkin, the author most recently of From Scratch, Inside the Food Network. If you have any interest in the culture of food in America, you should read this book.
You are listening to Real Long Way to Go by Brothers NYC on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I'm talking with Alan Salkin, author of A Comprehensive History of the Food Network. Actually, I should just say of Food Network. We can go there or not. Called From Scratch, Inside the Food Network. And I will remind people listening that if you have questions, here's your chance. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that isn't in the book that Alan could tell us about the people that and the studios and the shows that you love. You can call us at 718-497-2128 or write us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. If you prefer to tweet, you can tweet us questions at Taste Matters HRN. And don't worry if you're not listening live. Many of you listen to the podcast or the archive, and we'll try to get an answer to you either written or on the air if you have sent in a question. So back to this idea of the end of a run, let's say. A surprise to me, maybe the hero of this book in some ways, is Bobby Flay, who from both sides, the audience and the administration, let's say, was malleable, flexible, smart enough to come up with new ideas while everyone just went with their BAM and their shtick and reached an end point.
Yeah, I literally, when I signed the book to him, I said, "You're the hero of the book." So you're very perceptive, I have to say, in picking that out. Or maybe I was good at portraying that, because I'm not saying he's an unflawed hero. I'm not saying
no,
that.
No, nor do I think he would say that.
Yeah, nor. Yeah. No, definitely. But Bobby is the perfectly evolved creature for this ever-changing thing. Bobby is basically a New York City street kid. You ask him where he went to college, he'll say UCLA, which the University of the Corner of Lexington Avenue. And he just has this amazing ability to coldly, like, figure out who's in charge, who's got the power, and what it's going to take for him to, like, keep surviving. And he's just evolved and evolved. And you look at Throwdown, he deliberately loses on Throwdown because he knew people thought he was sort of the shifty, you know, untrustworthy character. This is people read a little bit when they see him on TV. They don't connect. And he realized by losing, a little punk, a little bit, by losing to people all around the country, he got sweeter. And it's helped
amazing.
His brand. You know, one of the things that from what you were saying earlier about, you know, the story of the network. The network is so controlling of these people's images and of its own image that I think there is this desperate hunger for people to know more about these stars who they feel like they're their family members, and they're not getting the information that they want about their family members. And some of that's in this book. And I see it as I travel around. People want to know, well, what's going on with Ina and Jeffrey? And, you know, what are they, not just what do they really like, but like, where do they come from? What is it about them? And
we were just talking about Ina and Jeffrey on Sunday night with my sister was visiting, and we were watching a show, and it's like, you know, we filled in the details, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff. They really are in your life.
People want to sit at that table with Ina, and people are upset that she's now cooking in the barn and it's not her real kitchen because they want to be there.
And Nate and I want to be their gay friends because they only seem to have gay friends in the Hamptons, but there you go, who they're feeding, Ina and Jeffrey.
I'm straight, and I wrote a lot of the book out there, I'll just say that.
So another theme, there are lots of themes in the story, the randomness in some ways, or let's just see it. And then the another theme might be it doesn't work show one, but by the second series, we'll make something happen. One was that they were cheap as shit.
I mean,
they wouldn't spend a nickel. And so they sort of got what they had, and perhaps that's why they had to work with it, because they weren't paying for talent. They weren't paying for studios. They weren't paying for running water, for God's sakes.
That's right. They, you know, they sinks emptied into slop buckets, and they tapped into the sprinkler system for running water. But the it's true that that led them to some crazy experiments. They probably never would have gotten Two Fat Ladies if they weren't just looking, which is one of the best shows they've ever had.
Right.
Even the deal they made for the original Iron Chef, that was a good deal at a time they didn't have money. But it, what served them, I think, to start with that cheapness and that let's just try things, hey kids, let's put on a show, you know, and a fear of not much fear of failing because nobody was watching, so let's try things. I think as other competitors came on with Top Chef, which is an expensive show, it has cost Food Network by the low production values and their continued unwillingness to spend. You know, they're starting they're finally starting sort of a show to compete with The Chew, which is the daily talk show on ABC. But they're doing it like 13 episodes, one episode a week on Saturday mornings. And it's like, how is that really going to catch on?
Meet the Press sandwich or something, right? I live my life in a community of people who love to hate the Food Network.
Yes.
We are the foodies, the whatever. You know, my doctoral dissertation was actually about the positive influence that all media have, I think, in cultural forms, particularly food, because they create space in a very crowded area for us to think about food, regardless of what they're doing. And so I've always been very positive, even when Amanda Hesser wrote that vicious takedown of Emeril. I just thought, you're missing, this is exactly why the Food Network has to exist, because there's this huge gap between the foodies who are the snobs and the connoisseurs, and I mean, even if they're generous and open, are the knowers, and everyone else who wants to play.
And James Beard and Julia Child would say the same thing.
Right.
You gotta fill that space. Make it entertaining and bring people back to the kitchen. And the network did create, you know, leave a breadcrumb trail, even with Rachel Ray, who Emeril opposed at first.
It
you know, because he thought this was a network of chefs that, welcome people back to the kitchen. But I do agree that there's a snobbery towards the Food Network now, which wasn't the case in the 90s when it really was. It felt like at least it was this chance to spread the gospel of this foodie way of life,
right.
I think.
We were certainly rooting for it. It's funny. Yesterday was my 20th anniversary at the James Beard Foundation, and it's the 20th anniversary pretty much of the Food Network. My first article was on the launch of this food channel, but we couldn't watch it, which was part of the early story in Manhattan. It wasn't carried right away. I replaced Dory Greenspan, who went to go write for TV Diners or Dinners or whatever it was called. But you've seen it change, and it's never been a huge part of my life, quite honestly, because I don't watch that much television, but I just think it has made our current life possible in really profound ways. I mean, obviously there's social media and all that change in media, but it's been this constant companion, the family member on TV stations that has brought food, quote unquote, into people's lives.
And there's an archetype. You know, if you go to the gym, it's ESPN and it's the Food Network.
Yes.
There's something about watching somebody by a fire cooking something for us, which is the oldest show on earth, and we like it.
Right.
What can I say? It has been with us all those years.
Do you So now you are an expert.
Yes.
On this. I mean, perhaps willing or unwilling, it's certainly a story that you tell. Do you see? I mean, you've said you think they're sort of stagnant a little bit, but do you see through other TV media the way food is playing out, and even in social media, things happening that you think are good things, you know, besides the competitive eating and the obesity in America? Well, you know, there's all this food stuff out there.
You know, and also in a more loquacious response to your previous question, also that, you know, what it was when it started was there was Berkeley, there was San Francisco, there was Southern California, maybe Charlie Trotter, maybe some places in New York, and it found this, you know, this small subculture of what was happening in food, and it has spread it to the masses. And the fact that you can go all over the country now and find good food is partly because of the Food Network, not just because of food blogging and people like us, right? So the question is, now that everybody knows how to cut an onion without cutting their fingers, even though some of us still cut our fingers sometimes.
And some of us know it, but we'll never touch an onion.
Well, contact lenses help, actually, protect your eyes. But, what is next? What is there still to deliver? What knowledge? Is it just going to be entertainment? And, of course, as people unplug from from cable, which they are because of the cost, how are we going to get our food content? And, you know, if I was running Food Network, I would say, guess what, guys? We're going to stop chasing every rating, but only, which is in TV is crazy, but just for like a year.
Right.
And we're going to put on all these shows that people keep asking for. We're going to try a vegan show. We're not just going to put one on a Saturday night and say, look, no
it
one's watching.
Work, right?
We're going to try a show with Justin Warner, who they one Food Network star, and everybody complains they didn't give him the show. He said they were going to give him. We're going to try some out there programming and stick with it, and get credit among the food hipsters, of which there's millions and millions now. Even Cooking Channel, which was supposed to be delivering those viewers, that voice, that Brooklyn/Portland voice, hasn't done it.
Right. And without that sort of chef du jour, the garden of to produce these things has become the spectacle itself, the reality, blah blah blah, the contest for this. And so where do they come from? It's interesting.
Where do they come from? Where do the voices? And you know, it's people producing their own internet. You know, it's the same thing, their own shows on the internet. And but what, you know, it's that plus. But now it's this thing. It's a brand. You know, they want people. Look at Paula Deen and what happens. Like when you. Right. If you rely too much on human beings are a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes back to the very start of when Scripps bought the network. You know, they wanted formats. They didn't want people because people are problematic. Formats, you can just replace people. But people connect to people.
Right.
And it's this tension at the network. And if you want to have a person who you can trust to make a multi-million-dollar deal with Kohl's to sell a brand of whatever, that's a different business than just trying to create entertainment and drill dry wells and try crazy things. And I don't know how it's all going to shake out. I'm hopeful, though. You know, like you, I kind of do love this network in a way, and I appreciate what it's done for us. And there's times when I really do like watching it. I hope they can come up with something.
Right. I want to talk 2 seconds also about what's next for you, but do you think when they see a parody like the Guy Fieri Saturday Night Live thing they just did, that they think that's success, or does that sort of
They are not people with a great sense of humor.
I
think Guy likes it. I think the Guy is smart, and Guy is like, I live my whole life to be parodied on Saturday Night Live. Wouldn't you? I mean, yes.
Right.
Guy's childhood heroes, Evel Knievel and Elvis. He's a great American
and he is,
showman.
Right. Must be their child, their stepchild.
Absolutely.
Right.
And so I think they don't, you know, there was a roast of Anthony Bourdain a couple years ago, and they don't laugh a lot, those Scripps people.
Right. And for you, this is a chapter, obviously, of your life. What's on the horizon? Do you know? Are you just
I don't know. There's a Leonard Cohen poem where he talks about his mentor, Irving Layton, and the poem goes, every time I was going to start a new project, Layton would say to me, but Leonard, are you absolutely sure it's the wrong thing to do? So, you know, I think there could be a movie in From Scratch. I think there could be a TV series. But I've, you know, when you do a book, you've got to, like, I'm sure you know from your dissertation, and all the work you've done, there's you've got to set a lot of other things aside. So I've got 10 things burning through my brain, some of which are probably stupid ideas.
Right.
And who knows? Maybe I'll emerge January 2nd and know what to do.
Good. Well, we will look forward to that. In the meantime, I strongly encourage everyone listening to buy and read this book. It's a great read, and it's really educational, I think, especially in our media-saturated day. You really come out feeling smarter about the biz, let's say. Thanks for being with us, Alan.
Such an honor to be here. Thank you.
Next week, we are closed, and the week after that, the studios are closed for the holidays, but we will be back first thing in the new year with Liz Newmark, who is the founder and president and chief poobah of Great Performances, one of the great and giant catering companies. And she's got a new book called Sylvia's Table. And she's an important and sort of powerful person in the food security, food access, farm-to-table movement. So we'll look forward to that conversation to start 2014 off right. In the meantime, turn on the TV, turn your dial to whatever it is, watch something, have dinner with Ina and Jeffrey, whatever. Enjoy the holidays. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.